Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Since former Vice President Joe Biden officially announced his candidacy to lead the 2020 Democratic ticket, the big issue has ceased to be health care coverage or tax rates or child care or the environment. It isn't even about trust or stature or even charisma. The watchword has been electability.
Well, right now, what people are thinking about in terms of Joe Biden is electability.
We hear a lot about electability concerns regarding Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or Bernie Sanders.
The Democrats are putting their number one issue as electability. They want to make sure that they can win in 2020.
My focus group doesn't care who the nominee is. They just care about winning.
The wise investment of a vote is hardly a new concept, and it has been fed election cycle after election cycle by the media, who have long since set themselves up as arbiters of electability based on early polling, party support, donor bases, and war chest totals. Their determination, however dubious, thereupon governs allocation of press resources, the most supposedly electable candidates getting the most coverage. Thus, as in any horse race, the handicappers influence the betting. But this year, a new wrinkle, as Chuck Todd hinted at, and as the New Republic's Alex Perrine addressed in a recent essay, voters seem to be increasingly behaving like pundits, subordinating candidates' records and positions while themselves trying to divine electability. And what happens? The early polling based on the electability calculus establishes frontrunners, and the horse race coverage is more distorted than ever.
What I find interesting is that by the old invisible primary standards, there are a lot of candidates who should be popping, as it were, who should be doing really well, who are kind of struggling.
Perrine's essay is titled, "Democrats Have Created an Electability Monster."
When you talk about who the donors lined up behind or who party insiders lined up behind, they lined up very early on, a lot of them behind Kamala Harris, who has just been struggling in the polls. And when reporters talk to voters, they say, oh, we love her, but we don't think she can win.
Hmm. And yet, by all the traditional metrics, she would seem to be a bona fide front runner. I mean, she is a U.S. senator. Perfect resume in an old school sort of way, ex-prosecutor, ex-state attorney general, but little traction because those being polled have internalized this question of electability?
What used to happen would be you could sort of tell voters who is electable, and you know, the media had a role in this and the party had a big role in this. They would say, look, John Kerry's electable, and you might like Howard Dean, but he's not electable. And, you know, this was party people saying this and voters sort of internalizing it. What's crazy to me this cycle is that party insiders are trying to tell voters, look, Kamala Harris is electable. And they are so shell-shocked by Hillary Clinton losing that they're refusing to believe it. And the concept of electability has gotten out of the hands of the people who used to define it.
I just want to make sure I understand this. You believe that voters have heard so much about electability over all this time and were so burned by Hillary Clinton that they are actually making that and not the candidate's own resume or policy agenda or charisma, the basis of their support. They're trying to figure out what other voters are going to think about the race.
Yeah, exactly. I use this as to explain sort of why Joe Biden is doing so well in the polls and why people like Harris are not. And I don't mean to downplay his real support in the party, especially among older moderates, but you see a lot of, both anecdotally and in polling, you see people telling pollsters and telling reporters, look, Joe Biden, probably not my first choice, but I think he can win. And their sort of calculus for this is, well, other people will find him agreeable.
Eight Florida Democrats, most of them still undecided.
Why are you already committed to Joe Biden?
First and foremost, I think he can beat Donald Trump.
I think that he reflects the values of Democrats enough to get support from all wings of the party.
I think Joe Biden's the only candidate who could really pick up the moderate votes, the votes in the middle.
Not that I like him the best, but imagining a sort of theoretical other voter in the future who will like him.
You're describing Family Feud.
£3, survey said. 5 pounds was the number one answer.
Not what you think is the answer, but what you think those polled think is the answer.
Yes, exactly. What do you think the studio audience would say? Which candidate would they like the best? Well, I think what they don't realize is enthusiasm for a candidate is what makes a candidate electable. So saying, I'm extremely enthusiastic about Elizabeth Warren, but because I'm worried about electability, I'm going to go with a person I'm less enthusiastic about, end up nominating someone no one is really that excited for. That is sort of a mistake I think Democrats have made in the past, and they've downplayed it. And I feel like they should be worried if they think what is causing Biden to do so well is not actual enthusiasm for him as a candidate, but people who just tell themselves he's the only one who can beat Trump.
Permit me, please, Alex, to go off on this brief tangent. Once upon a time, there used to be something called disqualifiers. I remember when then-presidential hopeful Joe Biden was essentially disqualified when a speech he gave plagiarized a speech by British politician Neil Kinnock.
Essentially, Biden said, everyone does it.
The notion that every thought or notion or idea you'd have to go back and find and attribute to someone, I think is, quite frankly, ludicrous.
Biden has accumulated any number of negatives. The handsy, creepy Joe stuff, the non-apology to Anita Hill for his conduct during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, his Iraq war support, his very long history of gaffes before and during the Obama administration.
In Delaware, the largest growth in population is Indian Americans moving from India. You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent.
Has Trump erased the disqualifier factor as a factor?
Yeah, I mean, he really has, but in a way that's almost funny that the lesson taken from it would be that we have to look past the gaffes of Joe Biden and not that we can take a chance on an unlikely candidate, right? I would argue Republican voters were told the same electability stories that Democratic ones were, and the election of Trump was them throwing those concerns aside and saying, we don't care if the media says that they're unelectable. We just like him, and then they won.
What intrigued us about your piece is that it describes an electorate that has been sucked into the very illusion. It's, you know, it's a more crystalline form of political delusion.
Yes. What is, I think, slightly perverse about it is that voters have trained themselves in many respects to act like pundits, deciding not based on their policy preferences or charisma or biography, but on sort of these lessons that you might hear on a Sunday morning panel show. And the thing is, predictions made on Sunday morning panel shows are not usually very good. Pundits are not very good at their jobs. Having thousands or millions of amateurs trying to perform a job that no one is very good at and using that to decide who they're going to vote for, it does just seem like a very strange recipe.
Now, it seems inevitable that if voters are making decisions based on electability, that candidates will stop talking about arcane policy questions and start trumpeting their own electability. Is it happening?
It's definitely happening, yeah. And I think just last weekend, Kamala Harris made a point very similar to the one I wrote about and that we were just discussing earlier.
There has been a lot of conversation by pundits about the electability and who can speak to the Midwest.
She was telling an audience, like, look at my resume. I'm an extremely mainstream, extremely electable candidate. You know, there are versions of that argument are made by just about all of them. Even Bernie Sanders has an electability argument for himself.
I can defeat Trump, and every poll that I have seen suggests that we are ahead of Trump.
Some of his supporters will quietly tell you, like, look, he's an old white guy. and if you're going to Joe Biden because he's an old white guy, other voters will think the same thing. Every campaign has an electability argument they're trying to make. And when they're doing that, they're not talking about their program. They're not talking about what they plan to do in office and all these other things.
A lot of the conversation on electability seems to go back to George McGovern and his catastrophic race against Richard Nixon in 1972.
Have you set yourselves up to select a candidate who is necessarily more maybe representative of the Democratic base and less electable in a general election? I'm looking at 1972 George McGovern.
Why is it deemed so cautionary?
One answer is that you have a huge number of people in leadership in the Democratic Party who were around for that election, and it was the defining political moment, basically, of the beginning of their careers. And but, you know, it's funny because if liberals sort of have been learning that lesson of McGovern over and over and over and over again, conservatives took the exact opposite approach with Goldwater, who lost. Conservatives regrouped, the right regrouped, and they built around Goldwaterism and just ran it again and eventually reshaped the country. So I think some of the lessons of McGovern have been overlearned in part intentionally to prevent the Democrats from moving too far to the left, and in part just because, you know, we're talking about Democrats in power who witnessed Reagan and just thought to themselves, we just can't win if we try to run as liberals.
Does everybody have amnesia? I mean, Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in, obviously. There's no way a buffoon like Donald Trump could defeat her. She was just far too entrenched.
When it comes to Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, many analysts see them as inevitable nominees in the 2016 election.
Trump was unelectable. Obama was unelectable. Jimmy Carter came from nowhere. Harry Truman was the president of the United States, and he was deemed unelectable. It reminds me of the famous William Goldman line about Hollywood tastemakers. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Presidential cycle after presidential cycle. Who do we blame for this?
I mean, everyone. I don't know. At the same time, you can overinterpret the last election and you can forget all the lessons of all the other elections. It's true that no one knows anything. You know, especially people don't know who voters are going to respond to, and yet there's an entire industry that has a lot of money riding on hiring people to say, oh, I know who voters are going to respond to. It seems like the best thing to do would just be to, you know, report on the political history and not try to make predictions and then report on the candidates, you know, their policies and their biographies and things like that. But obviously, like, what people want to read and what they want to see is who's going to win.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alex Perine is a staff writer with The New Republic. The piece we're talking about is titled, Democrats Have Created an Electability Monster. What a girl wants, what a girl needs, what a girl wants, what a girl needs. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chetravedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited this week by executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. It is alleged that Brooke Gladstone will be back someday. I'm Bob Garfield.
Is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.